You can go ahead and be turning to Genesis 6 in your Bibles. Actually, most of our discussion today will be from chapter 7. But we'll review just a couple of things from the sixth chapter as we get started. If you happen to be visiting with us today and would like a copy of the discussion questions that we're going over today, just hold up your hand and Gary will get you one of those. Just a few questions on the text and a couple of things to kind of get us, work us through our study today. We're talking about the great flood. Well, that's not where I wanted to start. Let's try that again. Okay. All right, fine. We'll do it this way. We're talking about the great flood of Noah's day. In Genesis chapter 6, we looked at mankind's wickedness and corruptions, described as every thought of the intents of his heart was only evil continually. We looked at God's sorrow and his determination to bring judgment as a result of man's multiplied wickedness. We looked at the word corrupt that is used several times in chapter 6 about how man had corrupted his way, about how his thoughts and actions were corrupt. And it's interesting that God actually uses the same Hebrew verb to describe what he's going to do to man. It's translated destroy in most of our English translations. But it's actually the same verb. The idea is to ruin something. Man had ruined his purpose by perverting it, so God was going to ruin man through the destruction of the flood. But of course, we looked also at Noah, who is alone in his generation, righteous before God, and because of his character, he finds favor in the eyes of the Lord, and God entrusts Noah with what we might call the plan of salvation, at least as far as the flood goes. And I asked you to think about this Wednesday. Imagine being granted the earth's population nowhere near in size as what it is now, but imagine being the only person, or at least the only family on the planet who is doing what's right. That's the situation that Noah and his family are in. We looked at God's warning to Noah, his instructions to Noah, his promises to him. God says to him, I'm going to make a covenant with you and your family. And you're going to be delivered from this flood. We looked a little bit in chapter 6 also at some of the details given about the construction of the ark. We have a lot of unique terms in Genesis chapter 6. Ark is one of them. We mentioned Wednesday night. That term, which basically means a container, a vessel of some kind, that particular term is only used of Noah's Ark and the tiny little vessel that baby Moses was placed in the river in the book of Exodus. All the other appearances of our English word Ark, for example, the Ark of the Covenant, are translating a different Hebrew term. The term flood in Genesis chapter 6 is also unique. It is a verb that is used with, I think, just one exception in the Old Testament, exclusively of the flood of Noah's time. There are other words for flood that are used in other passages. Think about the fact there's some verbiage that is coined seemingly uniquely for or specifically for this event because it is so, what word do you want to use? Catastrophic? It is such a turning point in many ways in human and global history. You have unique words that are used for it. And that really brings us down to chapter 7. We ended chapter 6, verse 22. After God gave Noah all these instructions about building the ark and about the animals that he was going to bring into the ark, in order to preserve them from the flood, the land animals that he was going to bring in. Thus Noah did, according to all that God had commanded him, so he did. In Hebrews chapter 11, We spent just a little bit of time looking at the Hebrew writer's reflections on Noah's faith. That Noah, by faith, being warned of things not yet seen, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household. God's warning him about something that he has no evidence for other than the promise of God, that this flood is going to happen and that it's going to be as extensive and deadly as God says. Noah has only one basis for believing that, and that's the word of God himself. But Noah trusts in that. And as a result, well, we'll see what happens in chapters 7 and 8. First question for this morning in chapter 7. According to verse 1, why is it that only Noah and his family are told to enter the ark? All right. Do you remember Wednesday night we looked at something that Peter said, and we'll be looking at this again today. Something Peter remarked about Noah. Do you remember what he called Noah? All right, a preacher of righteousness or a herald of righteousness. And that very likely means that during this lengthy period that Noah has to be preparing, building this ark, he is also trying to get other people to believe the warning that God has given him. And now here we are in chapter 7 and verse 1, and it's time to enter the ark, and who goes in? Noah and his family. Because they alone have been found righteous before God in their time. Even after the example and presumably the words of Noah during all those years of preparation, still when the time comes, it's just him and his family that are preserved in this way. I asked you also to compare verses 2 and 3 in chapter 7 with verses 19 and 20 in chapter 6. In chapter 6, God says, verse 19, of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female, of birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind. Two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. Now here in chapter 7, in verses 2 and 3, God says something slightly different. What does he say? All right. He says in verse 2, take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female. That presumably means seven pairs. And of the animals that are not clean, two, a male and his female. Also of the birds of the sky by sevens, male and female, to keep offspring alive on the face of the earth. So why is it that God has Noah bring more of these clean animals than of the unclean animals? And remember, well, I'll talk about that in a minute. Just why, first of all? Okay, all right. Presumably, a couple of things. Number one, these animals are going to be for food, and number two, they're going to be for sacrificial offerings. Very often, those two things really go together. What we don't have in Genesis is any instruction recorded from God about clean and unclean animals, about dietary restrictions. You have that, of course, for the children of Israel in the book of Leviticus. You have a very detailed list of the animals that were considered clean and the criteria by which animals were judged unclean so that they would be fit for sacrifice and also for food. Did God give the same restrictions in Noah's day? Presumably some kind of instructions were given. We just don't have recorded exactly what they were. But it would seem that the purpose for which Noah's to carry more clean animals than unclean is food and sacrifice. How long is Noah going to be on the ark? You may have read ahead a little bit. Yeah. No, Noah and his family are on the ark for a year. Give or take a few days. Just a few days more than a year. That's a long time. They're going to need food to eat, and not just presumably not just grain and vegetables and things like that. God is going to say to Noah after they exit the ark that he has given him all flesh, all animals for food. Is that a changing of those dietary restrictions? There's a lot of debate about that. We'll talk about that when we get to it. But that would seem to be the purpose for which God says, take seven pairs of each animal that is clean in terms of the instructions that had been given, two of every kind that was not clean. But again, what's the purpose, what's the general purpose for which these animals are being brought on the ark in the first place? Yeah, preservation. Because if they're not on the ark, they're going to die. Well, more on that in a minute. Verse 4, what does God say is going to happen next? All right. He says, after 7 more days, I will send rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made. So verse 5 again records, no, here Noah did according to all the Lord commanded him. 7 days. Perhaps it took 7 days to get all the occupants aboard the ark. I can only imagine the logistics involved and what Noah had to do. But anyway, God says, here's what I'm going to do. He's reiterating his promise. How old was Noah when the flood occurred, according to verse 6? All right. Can you imagine being say, 480 years old and being given the project of building the ark? Can you imagine being 80 years old and being given the project of building the ark? Okay. We're dealing with, obviously, the lifespans of, in the patriarch age much longer. But this is Noah's age. We read in chapter 5 about him being 500 when he became the father of Shem and Ham and Japheth. Now here it is 100 years later, and here's the flood account, dated very precisely in terms of Noah's life anyway, in verse 11, 600th year, second month, 17th day of the month in Noah's life, this is when this event happens. So how does Genesis 7 describe, first of all, the natural events that caused the flood in verses 11 and 12? Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. It's very, really very picturesque language that verses 11 and 12 use. The fountains of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened, okay, or the windows of the heavens, some translations have it. There is a lot of interest, and I won't go into details because I don't really have the knowledge and wherewithal to do it, but there's a lot of interesting ideas. There are a lot of interesting ideas about some of the specifics of the flood. We talked about this just a little bit on Wednesday. One of the questions that is often asked is before the flood happened, had it ever rained before? Earlier in Genesis, back in chapter 2, there is mentioned that at that time, of course, we're still in the garden, it had not yet rained on the earth, and there was a mist or vapor that went up from the earth and watered things. Was that the condition that prevailed up until Noah's time? The Bible just doesn't tell us. There are some interesting theories about perhaps a vapor canopy that surrounded the planet up until the time of the flood, that might have been responsible for the long lifespans and a lot of other things. Like I said, the Bible just doesn't say one way or the other. It's a lot of interesting stuff to speculate and read about. Go to it if that's your thing. Read away. It's very interesting. Same thing with what is described in verses 11 and 12. Some commentators think when verse 11 talks about the fountains of the great deep being opened, it's not just underground springs and even springs at the bottom of the ocean that is in reference, which would seem certainly to be included, but it might even involve geological activity of a greater magnitude than that. Lava displacement, tectonic plate shifting, and all kinds of things like that. And when you consider those possibilities, it may very well be that the earth looked very different geologically before the flood than afterwards. I don't know if that's the case or not, but it's something interesting to think about. At any rate, even though Genesis doesn't give a detailed description, what it does describe is something cataclysmic, something that is just almost unbelievable in its devastation and in its scope. Another thing that has often been kicked around in debate circles is, was this a universal flood that covered the entire planet? Or was it just a more localized flood limited to what we would probably call the Near East or the Middle East, where presumably the Earth's population resided in that day? Of course, again, a lot of presumptions would go into that. I think there are several indicators in the text itself that point to a universal flood. Here's several of them. In fact, this is your next question, part B. The extent of the flood and the effect of the flood. All flesh that moved on the earth perished, including all mankind, the text says. Every living thing that lives on the land dies. All the high mountains, everywhere under the heavens, were covered. That's the language that the scripture uses. Of course, we're going to see it takes a year for the waters to fully abate and the land to dry. And here's kind of an inference. Why would Noah need to build an ark and bring all the animals into it in order to escape a flood that was localized, that he could have just run away from rather than requiring the building of the ark? Those are some things that I think point toward a universal flood. Of course, there's, again, interesting debate on both sides of that. But you have to take the Bible at its word that all life is, all land living animal and human life is destroyed by this flood. That's the whole point of the flood. That's the whole point of this judgment that God brings. Questions? Comments? I'm talking too much. Y'all need to let y'all have at it. Go ahead, Shane.
I was discussing this with Roger Blackwell a few months ago, and he pointed out I had never done the math, but Methuselah dies right around the same time as the flood. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it kind of begs the question, was Methuselah one of the wicked, or did he die before so that he was spared? Or, you know, so this is hyperbole that, you know, we see in other places where it says
And especially because Methuselah that you mentioned, he's presented to us in Genesis 5 in the righteous line. We have that contrast between chapter 4, the descendants of Cain, who are all about promoting themselves and making technological improvements, as it were, versus the ones in chapter 5, the descendants of Seth, who are primarily about walking with God. And it's Methuselah is in that line, not the other. So yeah, those are interesting questions. I don't have an answer, as like you said, we can't know for sure. Think about this though. Do you think Noah lived in total social isolation up until the time of the flood? I doubt it. think he had friends and family members who perished in the flood? It's a hard thing to think about. We rarely think about the emotional difficulties that may have involved. Think about the same thing with Lot in the destruction of Sodom. Surely by the time Sodom was destroyed, he had made some acquaintances, maybe even in such a wicked place, maybe even a few friends, or at least people that he could tolerate and could tolerate him. And of course, he lost some family members as well. Leaving meant leaving them behind. Getting on the ark meant leaving people behind that Noah may have come to care about. But he got on the ark anyway because he believed God's promise. Sometimes when we are, sometimes when we're teaching, we'll encounter somebody who is processing what the Bible says about God's plan of salvation. And their biggest hang-up is that they have people they love who haven't done that. And they'll say, but if I do this, then I'm condemning good old beloved so-and-so, who may or may not still be living. Sometimes they'll invoke their dead grandmother or whatever it is, and tugging at the heartstrings. I get that. And I suspect people like Noah, people like Lot and others in similar situations had some of the same kinds of feelings of pity and affection for the people who were being left behind. And they were, as the writer of Hebrews said, in a sense condemning the world. That's what the writer of Hebrews says about Noah. But Noah didn't let that stop him from getting on the ark and from getting his family on the ark, because he believed the promise of God. And ultimately, that's what it comes down to when we're talking about salvation. And it's an important parallel because Peter's going to draw that parallel for us in a couple of ways, as we'll see in just a minute. How long, according to chapter 7, did the floodwaters prevail on the earth? All right, 150 days. I'm sorry, Lacey, I missed your hand. Go ahead. Okay, good point. So the water prevails on the earth for how long? Okay, 150 days. What is that? 5 months. That's we have 40 days and 40 nights of unbelievable rain and flooding. Unbelievable is not quite the right word. Okay, maybe. But it's believable. I believe it. I think you believe it. But something obviously Noah and his kin had never encountered before. And then for 5 months, the Bible talks about the water reaching 15 cubits above the highest mountaintop. And then after that period of time, the water slowly begins to recede. And we'll look at this in chapter 8. Talks about after so many days, the ark came to rest on a mountaintop, and after so many more days, the water continued to recede. But it's a long time before the water recedes enough and the land is dried enough that it is safe for Noah and his family to come out. This is immense. Gary?
But when you think about how much water is under the ground, like right here in Florida, we have, I don't know how many rivers that are underground. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing some kind of geologist before, 100 years ago, where they had discovered a source of fresh water underground. If I remember the statement right, they said they estimated that it was greater than all of the combination of lakes and other water sources. Mm. So how much
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And I'm not saying that to say I doubted the story about.
No, but it does give you a new perspective on what happened. Yeah, because we do. We tend to focus on the rain and forget about the fountains of the deep being opened, any other source, sure. A lot of water, yeah. Jeff?
Just to kind of aside from work, we have the regular aquifer in which we get our drinking water. They were trying to do some work in Polk County for carbon sequestration to exhaust. And there's a saline aquifer that's about a mile that I don't know how big that was, but they were going to pump this carbon stuff down into the saline aquifer. Mm-hmm. So
oh, yeah, multiple levels, sure, yeah, yeah. The New Testament makes use of Noah's flood in a number of ways. And I asked about a couple of incidents like that. Jesus in Matthew chapter 24, for instance, invokes the flood of Noah's day. Why does he bring it up? What point is he making? Okay, all right. Jesus talks primarily in that chapter about the coming destruction of Jerusalem. There are also at least allusions to the final day of judgment. I think the chapter is primarily, mostly about the destruction of Jerusalem. But he invokes the time of Noah and talks about them eating and drinking and giving in marriage and just, you know, going about life as usual, right up until the time that Noah and his family went into the ark. Not knowing, they're heedless of what's about to happen. They just think that life is going to continue on as it always has, and all of a sudden, there's judgment and it's all over. And that's how he says, so the coming of the Son of Man will be. Everybody thinks everything's all fine, going along perfectly as normal, and then everything comes to an end. For the people of Jerusalem, as hard as this is to believe, because they were in the middle of a revolt against Rome that was being responded to militarily, the assault on Jerusalem caught an awful lot of people by complete surprise. They didn't really believe that the Romans would do it. And there were thousands upon, according to historical sources, there were thousands upon thousands of people who had come to Jerusalem for Passover, when the Roman army showed up and blocked them all in and prevented their escape and laid siege to the city. They knew they were at war, they knew the Romans were responding, but they figured everything was going to go on like it had, and it didn't. What about the final day of judgment? Paul and Peter both describe it as coming like a thief. Just like in the days of Noah, everything is going on, life is just going on as it always has, until suddenly it isn't. No warning, and judgment comes. That's how it was in Noah's time too. What about Peter? I find it interesting that Peter uses Noah's flood multiple times in his letter. And by the way, with Jesus referring to it and Peter referring to it, among others, the writer of Hebrews, multiple references, these writers are describing the flood of Noah's day as a historical fact. They are using the factuality of it to make their point. Jesus does that. Peter does that. This is not a story. This is not a legend. This is not a bedtime story that's got a nice point to it. From the perspective of these inspired people, including Jesus, the Son of God, the story that's recorded in Genesis 6, 7, and 8 is the way it happened, a series of actual events. Peter, 1 Peter chapter 3, how does Peter use the narrative of the flood in that chapter? What lessons does he draw from it? 1 Peter 3, and I asked you to look at verses 20 and 21.
Salvation
Okay, all right.
He also talks about the long-suffering of God.
Okay, yeah. Both of those things. You have really a couple of lessons that Peter draws. Really, the discussion begins back earlier in the chapter, but we're picking up in verse 20 when he's talking about the situation in Noah's day. People who were once were disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark. Remember, we saw this Wednesday night. I think the right conclusion from the text of Genesis 6 is that God was going to give what we would call a grace period of 120 years for the until the judgment of the flood. He gives Noah a lot of time to build the ark, seeing as how Noah's got to start this project all by himself. God says, my spirit will not struggle with man forever, but his days will be 120 years. Peter talks about the patience of God that kept waiting in the days of Noah. Why does God delay in bringing this judgment of the flood? Okay. Yeah. All right. He wants people to have an opportunity to be saved. First and foremost, Noah. Because he gives Noah instruction. God could have saved Noah from the flood, I suppose, in any number of ways. But the way he chose involved Noah's participation, his preparation of the ark. That's going to take some time. God is patient in waiting for Noah to complete the task that he has given him so that he and his family can be saved. And presumably, also so that others might have the same opportunity through the preaching, the example of a person like Noah to change their hearts and possibly also be saved. So Peter emphasizes the patience of God that kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark. And then he says, in which a few, that is 8 persons, were brought safely through the water. We said this Wednesday night. The same water that is the element of destruction for everyone else and everything else is also, in a very real sense, the element of deliverance for Noah and his family because they're in the ark and it's designed to do one thing, float. And it does. So the same water that destroyed also saved. So Peter says they were saved through or brought safely through the water. And then says in verse 21, corresponding to that, baptism now also saves you. Baptism now saves you, not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience. Peter says just the same way that water was involved in Noah's salvation, water is involved in ours. I remember having a discussion with somebody who didn't like, a lot of people don't, but this person didn't like what Peter says about baptism in verse 21. Peter says it saves you. That's a pretty blunt and hard to miss statement about the role of baptism in salvation. And his argument was, well, it doesn't mean salvation from sin. I asked him, well, then what does it mean? What does saved mean? And his answer was basically, I don't know, but it doesn't mean that, is what it came back to. What was Noah saved from? All right. Death, destruction, judgment. The end of the world as far as Noah, okay. What is Peter talking about us being saved from in verse 21? All right. Conceptually the same things, even though we're not talking about a flood of water. We're not talking about the mere loss of life. We're talking about a judgment from God. Peter says, the same way Noah was saved through water, you are too. How about 2 Peter chapter 2? This little section, verses 4 through 10. How does Peter make use of Noah's story in 2 Peter chapter 2? Yeah, go ahead.
The passage here, First Peter, it's Peter makes a commentary on how a few were saved, and that is a story that we see from the beginning of time. God talks Jesus talks about the people that will be saved walking on narrow and wide roads. There will be just a few that are saved. And so that's a theme that we see throughout the Bible, all the way to Peter when he talks about how just a few were saved then. And it's assuming that when he talks about in a like manner baptism now saves you, there will probably be a few that are saved there.
A good point. Yeah, that's everything you said about that being a running theme is right, and that would seem to be an implication of what Peter's saying here. Yeah, great point. All right, go ahead, Charlie. Yeah.
God's patience also makes man baptized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lord, if you'd just given us a few more months, we'd have got it turned around. Yeah, that's an important point too, and you see that as a repeating pattern as well. That God's patience leaves people without excuse for disobeying Him. All right? 2 Peter chapter 2, how does Peter make use of the Noah story?
God is able to deliver the righteous from trials.
Okay. Peter actually gives a number of examples here, starting with verse 4, angels who sinned, and he says, God did not spare them, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment. And then in verse 5, he speaks of Noah's day. And really, two things in with the exception, really, the first example, two things are at work, because the next, Peter gives the example of Noah and the example of Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah. And in both of those cases, he emphasizes two things. Number one, God not sparing the wicked. He did not spare, verse 5, the ancient world, and condemned it, sent that flood on the world of the ungodly. And also verse 6, he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction. But the flip side of that is that he not only condemned the wicked, he preserved the righteous. In Noah's case, it was Noah and his family aboard the ark. In Lot's case, he preserves Lot, who was righteous and oppressed by the sensual conduct of those unprincipled men. Peter gives these examples to say, verse 9, here's the conclusion, if God can do all that, if God did all of that, not if we read stories about that, but if God actually did those things that we're talking about, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. So in Peter's mind, in Peter's inspired mind, there are two things that these historical judgments are a guarantee of. That when God says He's going to bring judgment, He's going to bring judgment. God will punish the wicked. But also that when God promises to bring salvation to those who put their faith in Him, He will bring it. God has the ability to do that, and He has the goodness to make good on those promises. Peter could have given any number of other examples that reflect the same thing. In fact, Jude, in his little letter, does something very similar, and he gives the example of the people of Egypt, or the children of Israel being delivered from Egypt, for example, but similar points being made. Jude's point is more focused on the destruction of the ungodly. But here's Peter making use of the historical fact of Noah's day as a guarantee that God makes good on His promises of judgment and His promises to deliver the righteous. We've got one more that's in 2 Peter chapter 3. Chapter 3, really verses 3 through 7. Peter mentions the flood as part of this discussion. What use does he make of the fact of the flood? Okay. All right. Yeah, he begins this with, you know, in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, saying, where is the promise of His coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. Peter says when they say things like this, they're overlooking some important things. They're overlooking that first of all, it's by the word of God that the heavens and earth existed, that the earth was formed out of water and by water. And verse 6, here's our flood reference, through which, through water, the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. Then he says, the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, according to verse 7. His point again is to argue that God's promise of coming in judgment against the world is somehow invalidated by the fact that so much time has passed and everything's going along just like it always was. Well, remember what Jesus said in Matthew 24? Yeah, everything's going along just like it always has. That doesn't mean God's promise is no good. Peter says they forget that God has judged the world in the past. When God has promised to judge the world in the past, He has delivered on that promise. So again, there is, and again, notice verses 8 and 9, he's going to talk about the patience of God. Verse 9, not wishing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. So these are recurring themes that Peter draws on, and draws on the flood narrative in highlighting many of these important points. Those are some of the uses that are made of the story of the flood, the narrative of the flood in the New Testament. Because it is an important event of divine judgment and divine mercy. So it's an important thing for us to learn from. There are lots of other biblical events that teach the same lesson. None of them on the scale of the flood, though. We're talking about worldwide destruction and only 8 human beings being brought out of it alive. Them and the animals that were with them on the ark. That's a hard lesson to miss unless we choose willfully to miss it. Questions or comments before we finish up this morning? We're going to look in chapter 8 on Wednesday night at the continuing narrative of the flood, the receding of the waters, and maybe talk about some other lessons and applications to make. Go ahead, Barry. Yeah, I haven't mentioned this, but lots of ancient cultures had a flood story, there's the Babylonian Gilgamesh epic, and there's several others, and that is reflective of something that actually happened. Obviously, It's a lot like pagan religion in general. There's a dim shadow of spiritual reality that has gotten perverted and twisted, and that's what you have in all these flood stories. But there's a universal recognition among those ancient cultures that something happened. Now, Barry makes a good point. Here is God clarifying for the Israelites what exactly happened. But more importantly than that, who was involved in it? Because this is the same God. The same God that brought the judgment against Noah's world is the one who has now called the Israelites out of Egypt and is bringing them toward something He has promised them. Well, how do they know He's going to do that? Well, look at the promises He made to Noah. He kept those promises. That's a lot of what you see in Genesis, a lot of the importance of Genesis for its original audience, those people in the time of Moses. Great point. We'll leave with that, and we will pick up in chapter 8 Wednesday night.